From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. The dust is settling on another wild week in American politics. There was the acquittal of President Trump, and Democrats are in disarray because the Iowa caucuses are still too close to call.
And tonight in New Hampshire, seven of the Democrats running for president will square off in another debate just days ahead of the first-in-the-nation primary there. Our Friday roundtable joins us now. We've got Beth Fooey, a senior politics editor at MSNBC and NBC. She joins us today from New Hampshire Public Radio. Hi, Beth.
Hey there.
And Jesse Holland, host at C-SPAN's Washington Journal. He is in Washington. Hello, Jesse.
How you doing?
Pretty good, thanks. And let's start with you, Jesse. I'm going to set the stage for tonight's debate. Pete Buttigieg, of course, will be there. He now appears to have won Iowa by a razor-thin margin over Bernie Sanders, though both are claiming victory, and it kind of does depend on how you count. Elizabeth Warren will be there, Joe Biden, Amy Klobuchar, and Andrew Yang and Tom Steyer. Those two barely registered in Iowa. But Jesse, is tonight's debate going to feel different now that the stakes are getting so much higher?
Oh, yes. It's in this debate tonight that we will actually see the knives come out. The great thing about winning Iowa is that you get that boost coming out of the state and moving into New Hampshire. The bad thing about winning Iowa is that tonight everyone will be after Buttigieg and Sanders. Every idea that people can think that will hurt them if you're a Democrat, they're going to throw out in the debate tonight. Because coming out of Iowa is South Carolina, and if people like Joe Biden can't get a boost in New Hampshire in the primary there, it might see the end for several of the other candidates in the race.
That's really interesting, Jesse. Beth, I want to talk to you a little bit about, okay, all eyes will be on Buttigieg and Sanders, but I'm thinking about 4 years ago during the Republican New Hampshire debates when then Governor Chris Christie turned the tables on Senator Marco Rubio. It was not only embarrassing for Rubio, but it basically eclipsed his rapid rise in the polls. Now that this Democratic field is narrowing, aside from Biden, what other candidates do you see having a similar turning point in this race?
Well, there's so many to look at because normally after Iowa, the field narrows considerably. A bunch of candidates typically drop out. Because we had that that mess in Iowa, nobody's dropped out. Everybody's sort of resetting here in New Hampshire. And yes, of course, we did see that it was Pete Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders coming out essentially tied. But nonetheless, we still do have this very large field. So there's a lot of three-dimensional chess going on. Bernie Sanders and Pete Buttigieg kind of vying against one another, kind of the more progressive side of the Democratic Party versus what Pete Buttigieg is trying to carve out as the more centrist side. You've got Elizabeth Warren, who had a disappointing third place showing, sort of a distant third place showing in Iowa. She's trying to be the one who says she can unite those two sides of the party while, you know, for so long being primarily affiliated with the progressive Bernie Sanders lane. She's now trying to say she can unite both sides. You've got Joe Biden, who has been the national front runner, but took a real drubbing there in Iowa. How is he going to recover? He's been talking about the first four contests as being all kind of one package, and that's how his campaign is viewing them. That means that's kind of code for saying he can lose both Iowa and New Hampshire and maybe get that firewall in South Carolina with those African-American voters who've been very supportive of him. So you've got a lot of dynamics going on today and through next Tuesday. I agree with Jesse that the knives really will be out for Pete Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders tonight of the debate, and their knives will be aimed at one another.
Joe Biden's going to have to go through Nevada first. They all will, so that's going to be before South Carolina. But what about this debacle in Iowa? I want to hear this tape from Bernie Sanders, who really blasted the Iowa Democratic Party for its inability to count the votes in a timely manner.
That screw-up has been extremely unfair to the people of Iowa. It has been unfair to the candidates, all of the candidates, and all of their supporters.
Jesse, pretty candid language there from Bernie Sanders. His supporters are also now calling for the head of the Democratic National Committee, Tom Perez, to step down. What do you make of this growing rift between Sanders and the party? It kind of feels like deja vu 2016.
Well, first of all, I mean, there's been a big push to get Iowa out of the lead for the Democratic and Republican contests for a long time.
Is that going to happen now? I'm curious.
Well, I mean, Iowa is going to try its best not to let it happen because it's a big boon for the state. But looking at the voters in Iowa, I mean, they don't really – are not really representative of the Democratic Party anymore. So Iowa's going to try its best to stay there. But a lot of the other states and some people in the party want Iowa to move out of the way and not be so determinative on who the Democratic candidate is going to be. And you have to admit, this was a huge mistake for Iowa. I mean, not being able to get the votes counted right, to come up with a new system of doing it, not doing the testing they should have. I mean, they've given ammunition for the Democratic Party to start thinking about moving them out of the way.
Beth, what about that rift between Sanders and the DNC, though?
So I think Bernie Sanders is voicing what probably all the candidates feel, and he's just feeling emboldened enough to put words to it in public. Look, as Jesse said, I mean, it's a state that has been kind of on the knife's edge about whether it could keep this first in the nation status. It really is not a representative state in any which way of the American population. Plus, it is not a battleground state for Democrats. It is a state that President Trump won by 10 points about in 2016. There's no real sign that Democrats are going to compete actively there in the general election. So it just kind of looked like a big boon to Iowa's economy and Iowa's status, while not returning what these candidates justifiably deserve, which is timely and accurate counting. What Bernie Sanders said is what they are all feeling.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about fears for the party itself and a nominee that can actually win. Here's Democratic strategist James Carville on MSNBC this week.
It matters who the candidate is. It matters what a party chooses to talk about. I mean, I'm 75 years old. Why am I here doing this? Because I am scared to death. That's why. And we got to let's get relevant here, people, for sure.
I mean, here is a prominent Democrat who supported Hillary Clinton, very afraid about the future. Jesse, what are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, that once again, this brings us back around to what the problem is with Iowa. Now, coming out with Pete Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders in the lead, will those two people be in the lead in Nevada and South Carolina, which are much more representative of what the actual Democratic Party looks like? So just because the majority white voters in Iowa, and frankly, even the majority white voters in the New Hampshire primaries, think that these two candidates are the ones who should represent the Democratic Party, will states that actually are representative of the Democratic Party think that? And I mean, frankly, that has a lot of people in the Democratic Party concerned that they'll come out with candidates out of these first two contests that aren't really representative of the entire party. That would concern me if I was in the Democratic Party as well.
Well, I am going to make it just a wild guess here that the two of you paid some attention to what President Trump was doing yesterday in the East Room of the White House, an hour-long kind of freestyle celebration, really, of his acquittal on two articles of impeachment. Let's listen.
They took nothing. They took a phone call that was a totally appropriate call. I call it a perfect call because it was. And they brought me to the final stages of impeachment. But now we have that gorgeous word. I never thought a word would sound so good. It's called total acquittal.
Beth, so here we have the president reveling in the triumph of his week. And at the same time, as we've been talking about, the Democrats just fighting over the terrible week that they just had. What can you say about the divergent paths that these two parties appear to be taking, at least at this moment?
Well, the news cycle moves so quickly in the era of Trump that, yes, it does seem like a pretty bad week for Democrats, pretty good week for President Trump this week. But who knows what next week is going to bring? Every day it seems that there's some huge newsworthy revelation out of Washington, out of the White House that distracts us and grabs our attention. But look, there are some enduring lessons here. Number one, the debacle out of Iowa definitely does expose problems within the Democratic Party that they desperately need to fix if they're going to mount a credible nominee against President Trump in November. But from Washington, what we're seeing once again is President Trump managing to escape. He's like Houdini. Any situation that he gets in where he is imperiled, somehow he manages to escape and to declare victory, to declare that he was right, that he was justified, and that he has no reason to apologize, express any sort of regret whatsoever. It's very much been the pattern of this presidency. People marvel at how it continues to happen over and over, but it definitely does sort of of show two different sides of survival. One, the Democrats, you know, sort of scrambling, and President Trump riding high.
Yeah, Jesse, your thoughts, of course, as Beth said, so much could happen in the next few days. But what are you looking forward to next week?
Well, while President Trump seems to always be able to escape by the skin of his teeth all of the things that imperil him, there's always that next thing sitting right over the horizon. And for him, it's still called John Bolton. Keep in mind, John Bolton's book has not yet been released. House Democrats are still talking about subpoenaing Bolton, who one of the few Republicans in public life that don't seem to have any loyalty to President Trump at all. So who knows what John Bolton would say if he comes in front of the House and testifies about what he saw with Ukraine. So while President Trump always seems to escape the ultimate punishment, these little tiny things that keep popping up here and there, we expect to see them all the way through to the election.
And it's hard to keep track of all those little tiny things. Jesse Holland is a host at C-SPAN's Washington Journal, and Beth Fooey, senior politics editor at MSNBC and NBC. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's Oscar season, and we don't want you to show up on the red carpet unprepared. That's why NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour is here to help you sort through the nominees and separate the best from the rest. Listen now, and we might even help you dominate your Oscars pool.
Another large utility in the United States has promised to go carbon-free by 2050. Arizona Public Service says it plans to close two coal-powered plants and by the end of this decade get 45% of its power from renewable sources like solar and wind. Big utilities across the country are setting similar goals, but are they moving fast enough? Joining us now is the new CEO of APS, Jeff Goldner. Jeff, welcome.
Thanks. Hi, Peter.
And first of all, you admit yourself that this is an ambitious plan. How do you plan to do it?
Yeah, it's an ambitious plan. So what we're talking about doing is decarbonizing by 2050. So that would be going to 100% carbon-free in our electric supply. And one of the challenges is we know how to integrate more renewables, but all of us are concerned about what we're going to need to do to get really the last bit of that carbon out of the system. And so it's going to be the tail end of the next 30 years that's going to require a lot of investment, a lot of new R&D so that we can figure out how to get to a zero carbon grid.
R&D in what? Are you referring to like battery storage power for a solar plant or something like that?
Yeah, R&D is really the central crux of what we've got to invest in now. So we've done good at getting solar prices lower, so the cost of solar electricity is good. Really the change now is moving into what do we do with storage? And there's two kinds of storage. There's short duration storage, shifting from the middle of the day when the sun's bright into the evening. There's also long duration storage, which is how do we get the amount of energy that we produce in the spring and the fall when we don't need it as much into the summer season where we do need it. The other one is how do we invest in things like hydrogen generation? So we know that we're going to need power plants that you can turn on with a punch of a button to maintain reliability. Right now, those are natural gas plants. There's a move to say, can we go to hydrogen-fueled combustion turbines, or can we do something to capture the natural gas that comes out of a natural gas turbine?
One of your goals is to close two coal power plants, one in Arizona scheduled to close, or was scheduled to close anyways, in 5 years, and another one that you own in New Mexico that is now set to close 7 years ahead of schedule in 2031. Coal, for a lot of companies, doesn't make sense anymore financially. So if that is the case, why not just shut those plants down now?
Yeah, the very important thing right now about the electric system is we've planned it to serve our peak demand. Our peak demand in Arizona, as you can imagine, is in the summer. And so right now, if we did not have our Cholla, which is the Arizona coal plant, and our Four Corners, which is in New Mexico coal plant, we wouldn't be able to keep the lights on in Phoenix during the summer. So you've got to move to say, how do I replace that generation with a different source, but maintain both reliability and affordability? Coal's been an important part of the history of Arizona for sure, but it's been necessary for us to actually keep the lights on, and it's going to be necessary for a while. So we're going to figure out how we're going to exit it early and replace it with generation that can maintain reliability and still keep affordability for our customers.
People who work in those plants and the communities that rely on those jobs might be concerned to hear this news. What will you do for them?
Yeah, it's an important thing that we have to do, which is look at how we make investments on, in particular, the Four Corners power plant, which is on the Navajo Nation.
a place that struggles financially very much.
It is. It's a tough economy there. And that power plant, and it's also got a coal mine attached to it, so it's called a mine mouth plant. And the power plant and the mine are a significant part of the Navajo Nation economy. And so some might say, well, go up and build a solar plant on the nation. And the challenge is that a solar plant, once it's built, will produce property taxes, but it won't produce high-paying jobs. It won't produce mining royalties. And so what we're going to be focused on is, can we do more economic development so that we can get some higher wage jobs, look at investing in that community to help it transition and really hopefully take advantage of some clean energy opportunities in that space as well.
Just 2 years ago, APS spent $38 million to defeat Proposition 127 in Arizona. This is a ballot measure that would have required utilities like you to get half of your energy from renewable sources by 2030. The goal you just announced is essentially the same. What has changed over those couple of years?
A couple of things that are important. First is that the goal here is carbon free. And Proposition 127 was focused just on renewables. So to us, it's very important that we protect the Palo Verde Generating Station, which is the largest generating station in the U.S.
Nuclear,
and it is 100% clean. The ballot initiative would have threatened it because it didn't really talk about clean. It just talked about renewables.
Big utilities across the country have already announced their carbon-free plans. Climate scientists, as you know, say there's really no time to waste if you are to avoid an irreversible climate disaster. Do you think that you could go even faster than carbon-free by 2050, and what would that take?
It's going to be difficult to do it while maintaining that affordability and reliability. I would never say never. R&D technology can be exciting. It's where a lot of the future is going to depend on us, on how we move. And you're right. I think we're the 14th utility who's announced a decarbonization plan in the U.S., and the energy industry in general is moving faster than any other segment in the economy to remove carbon from its system. What's more important, I think, than how quickly the electric companies can move is how quickly you can transition other parts of the economy onto a lower carbon energy system. So if we can move to a lower carbon energy grid and then move vehicles with electric vehicles onto that grid, you're going to have more of an impact on carbon than you would by focusing on, you know, the last 10% or so of the carbon in the electric grid.
I know you are a business. You have to answer to shareholders. How much of this is about money, the financial conditions of the utility market, and how much of it is about the climate?
You hear from our investors a steady drumbeat that they are concerned about what we're doing in what's called environmental social responsibility and governance. We have European investors, for example, and when we meet with those European investors, this is one of the first things they talk about is, what are you doing in decarbonization?
But coal just doesn't pencil out the way it used to either. That's the truth.
It is. In a large measure, the challenge that's affected coal across the United States has been the sudden resurgence of natural gas, largely from fracking. And as natural gas prices came down and stayed down, it became very difficult to economically operate a coal plant. In a lot of places, like in Arizona, that plant was a critical part of our energy mix, so you couldn't just eliminate it because you wouldn't be able to maintain reliability. But the economic pressures on coal have certainly been significant.
That's Jeff Goldner. He's CEO of Arizona Public Service. It's the largest utility in Arizona that recently announced plans to knock out its carbon emissions by 2050. Jeff, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, Sunday night is Oscar night, and it won't be surprising if someone uses the platform to advance a political agenda. Political statements at the Academy Awards have become so commonplace in recent times that it's hard to keep track of them all.
The struggle for freedom and justice is real. We live in the most incarcerated country in the world.
It's our time to have wage equality once and for all, and equal rights for women.
And to those of you out there who have ever felt injustice because of who you are or who you love, tonight I stand here in front of the world with you and for you. Thank you so much and good night.
That was John Legend, Patricia Arquette, and Jared Leto. All the way back in 1973, a young Native American actress took to the podium to protest the mistreatment of her people. And as KQED's Chloe Veltman reports, those words stand out to this day.
The winner is Marlon Brando in The Godfather. The night of the 45th Academy Awards, the tuxedoed and tiaraed denizens of Hollywood expected Marlon Brando to show up on stage and accept his Best Actor accolade for The Godfather.
I'm going to make him an offer again with you.
Instead, they got Sasheen Littlefeather.
Hello, my name is Sasheen Littlefeather. I'm Apache, and I'm pregnant.
The 20-something California actress and activist calmly explained Brando's decision to boycott the high-profile event and send her in his stead.
And the reasons for this being are the treatment of American Indians today by the film industry. Excuse me.
Now in her 70s, Littlefeather remembers being escorted off stage by a team of security guards that night.
All hell broke loose.
She says she narrowly avoided getting into a scrap with John Wayne in the wings. Wayne was the biggest name in old school westerns, which were riddled with negative stereotypes of Native Americans.
A lot of people were making money off of that racism of the Hollywood Indian. Of course they're going to boo. They don't want their evening interrupted.
In a 1973 interview with talk show host Dick Cavett, Brando explained his support for Native American causes.
Indians have been tragically misrepresented in films and in our history books, in our attitudes.
At first, Littlefeather was skeptical about Brando's show of support of Native Americans. So she got her neighbor, director Francis Ford Coppola, to deliver the movie star a letter she wrote, quizzing him about his intentions.
And it took him a year to get back to me, but eventually he did.
Littlefeather says she could see Brando was sincere. They struck up a friendship, which led to his request for her to stand in for him at the Oscars. But the fallout ruined her career.
I was boycotted from that time forward. I was never allowed on any of the major television shows. Major productions of films.
There still aren't many lead roles for Native Americans today, but things are slowly changing. At a recent talk in San Francisco, Oglala Lakota film producer Sarah Eaglehart credited Sasheen Littlefeather with paving the way for people like her.
Those of us that had to come afterwards in the industry are grateful for you standing up and fighting for us to have a voice and for our issues to be heard as well.
Littlefeather was a special guest at that event. She said one of the reasons she spoke out at the 1973 Academy Awards was because she hoped to see more young Native actors breaking barriers in Hollywood someday. For Here and Now, I'm Chloe Veltman.
Barnes & Noble has pulled the plug on a project to celebrate Black History Month. The National Bookseller, in partnership with Penguin Random House, released diverse editions, classic book titles, like Romeo and Juliet with Black protagonists on the covers. To put it mildly, it was not received well by the public and authors of color in particular, some calling it literary blackface. For more on this, we're joined by Justina Ireland, a vocal critic and author of Deathless Divide. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yes, well, thanks for being here. As I mentioned, along with so many others on Twitter specifically, folks have called this effort by Barnes & Noble literary blackface. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you're familiar with the original like minstrel show in blackface, where white performers would basically blacken their face to pretend to be black people to kind of make fun of that culture, this is kind of the literary version of that. It's really about taking a story that doesn't include black people and their identities and their experiences and trying to like retrofit it in after the fact.
Yeah, in this particular case, these were classic books, just with a cover that has
just a new cover.
Black
yeah,
folks on
just
it.
Just the veneer. Yeah. I think that's the big point here. If a publisher or Barnes & Noble had partnered with a publisher to rewrite literary classics with modern, authors of color, I think people would have been really excited about an initiative like that. But to take a month like Black History Month, when we focus on the accomplishments of Black Americans, and to take books that were written, without us in mind, it's insulting. It's just really kind of dismissive. And it also kind of gets us the message that Barnes & Noble thinks Black people don't read classics, because, most of us have already read these books. They've been in the literary canon, some of them for hundreds of years.
Hearing you
give your thoughts, it brings to mind for me American Dirt author Janine Cummins. She's the white author who has been widely criticized for what many have deemed as stereotypical depictions of Mexican migrants in her latest book. That controversy has opened up a wider conversation about who has access to power in the publishing industry. Do you see a through line there?
Oh, most definitely. I do think when you center a majority, you know, white perspective in publishing, and you've done that for, you know, hundreds of years, it's really difficult to understand how to include those voices that haven't been heard. And the default is always to just reach the people to the left and right of you who've already been there and say, hey, can you do this thing? This is a thing we should be doing. This is something we should be looking into, instead of welcoming new voices into the conversation.
In a statement on Wednesday, Barnes & Noble said this is not a substitute for Black voices or writers of color whose work and voices deserve to be heard, and that throughout this month, stores will continue to highlight a wide selection of books to celebrate Black history and great literature from writers of color. Do you see this as a tipping point for maybe getting at those larger issues that you've just talked about? And what are ways that you'd like to see Barnes & Noble take this misstep and move it further for something more productive?
I think every single time we have one of these kind of these controversies or these kerfluffles come up, we want it to be a learning moment. You go into the table, and those tables at Barnes & Noble are the first thing readers see. And sometimes they never get beyond those tables. So it would be great if we had like a new and emerging voices area in Barnes & Noble, where Barnes & Noble can put that effort forward and say, hey, we are going to support diversity. We are going to support these marginalized perspectives and see how we can get those voices in front of a larger audience.
That's Justina Ireland, author of Deathless Divide. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
A 100 years ago, the United States began its noble experiment. It took an amendment to the Constitution to ban the production and sale of alcohol. For a relatively brief 13 years, prohibition was the law of the land, but it changed the culture of the United States for generations to come. William Rohrabaugh is professor of history at the University of Washington. He's also author of Prohibition, A Very Short Introduction, and he joins us now. Professor, welcome.
Happy to be here.
And take us back 100 years. How did it get to the point that a freedom-loving country like the United States decided to outright ban alcohol?
It was a combination of circumstances. The biggest problem was that ever since the founding of the colonies, Americans were heavy drinking people. This heavy drinking, when you had cheap whiskey, which you did with all the corn coming from the Midwest, and as a result, there was a lot of whiskey drinking and a lot of public drunkenness. Child abuse and wife beating and crime and poverty. And after the Civil War, there were a lot of Civil War veterans who were self-medicating with alcohol. And so in the early 1870s, a number of women in the state of Ohio created the WCTU, the Women's Christian Temperance Union. The WCTU became the world's largest women's organization. It was not all that effective. And what changes things in the 1890s is the organization of a new group called the Anti-Saloon League. They joined together to campaign for local prohibition, then state prohibition, and then finally a national constitutional amendment to have nationwide prohibition.
Where was the alcohol lobby? I mean, if you, big alcohol companies of today would have never let this happen.
Yes. Well, the only place where there was wine was California. The California wine industry did have influence in California, but not outside the state. The distillers had discredited themselves. They were caught in a scandal in the Grant administration, bribing federal inspectors not to pay taxes. So no one wanted to have anything to do with the distillers, so the distillers were kind of out of it politically. The political power came from the brewers, and Americans switched after the Civil War from whiskey to beer, and almost all the brewers in America were German. Or German immigrants, or the children of German immigrants.
Well, I see where this is going. This happens in 1920, very soon after World War I.
Now, if you're trying to stop prohibition, the people who really wanted to stop this are the brewers and the saloon keepers, right? And so they have to funnel money into the politicians that will try to stop this. But they can't give money openly because that's too, that doesn't look good, right? So they give money through something called the German-American Alliance, which was founded in 1900 by the Kaiser as an official organization of German immigrants in the United States to promote friendship between Germany and America. And so in 1914, when World War I breaks out, the German-American Alliance is pro-German in all of its propaganda. You know, they're pro-German in the war, but they're also pro-alcohol.
Today, when I think of prohibition, I think of speakeasies, right. Mobsters, moonshine, all these efforts right. to take drinking underground. What actually right. happened as soon as that amendment went into effect?
Drinking went underground. It absolutely did. The obvious saloons that had licenses that were on street corners that were visible, they couldn't in most places actually operate very long. They had to close. The restaurants that served alcohol had to close. And instead, speakeasies opened in basements. In places that were where they didn't have signs on the door. Sometimes they were in apartment buildings, and they wanted to rent cheap rent. So a lot of the speakeasies were located in low-rent neighborhoods.
This must have been seismic.
Oh, yes, it absolutely – although, a large number of people did stop drinking. And maybe more accurately, a large number of people never started drinking. Because think about it. If you were born in 1900, the first time that you could take a legal drink would be 1933. And by the time you were 33 years old, perhaps you didn't care anymore. The heaviest drinking period in people's lives is in their 20s. So a lot of people, they became a light drinking generation. But of course, the speakeasies also became places where people did drink, and particularly in big cities like New York and San Francisco and Chicago.
Is it true that the cocktail came out of Prohibition?
Yes and no. The cocktail as a word was invented much earlier, before the Civil War. It comes from the 1850s. But the popularity of the cocktail dates from Prohibition, because a lot of the liquor that was available was poor quality. It simply didn't taste very good. And so if you mixed it with something, it tasted better.
By the early 1930s, this didn't take long. Public opinion had started to shift. Here is some very old tape of then presidential candidate Franklin Delano Roosevelt campaigning in 1932.
But there can be no possible misunderstanding. Let me read the provisions of the Democratic platform on this point. And let me add that it's in plain English. It begins, "We advocate the repeal of the 18th Amendment."
And turns out he made good on that pledge. The 21st Amendment was ratified by the end of his first year in office. No more prohibition.
It was ratified even faster than the 18th Amendment had been.
How did that happen so quickly?
Public opinion turned. It started to turn in the mid-20s, but I think what really did it was the rise of criminal gangs that were major gangs. You know, one thinks of Al Capone, right. of course, in Chicago. You know, the TV series Boardwalk Empire about Atlantic City is actually based on a real story. And Atlantic City was one of the major places of corruption.
So you got rid of one evil, but you got an even worse one in return.
That's what people decided by the early 30s. You no longer had tax revenue coming in from alcohol. Instead, you had to raise taxes of other types, particularly the income tax. And in addition to that, the bootleggers were getting rich. The price of alcohol did go up. During Prohibition, alcohol cost about five times as much as it did before Prohibition. Hmm. And, of course, all that profit is going right into the pockets of Capone and people like that. And they don't pay any taxes on any of that money either. So it was clear that the people who put this in, I mean, partly it was done as like patriotism in World War I, but it was also a kind of naivete on the part of people who said, oh, if we just pass a law, that will be the end of it. People will stop drinking. And they didn't grasp that people who liked to drink were not going to stop drinking just because there was a law.
That's why it's so interesting, because in modern times, the word prohibition comes up in the debate about legalizing marijuana.
Absolutely.
In the 1980s and the 1990s during the war on drugs. There were clear parallels to prohibition, where people were making the argument that cracking down on drug use would reduce crime and poverty and all those evil things you were talking about before that got prohibition going. Do you think that the prohibition had a lasting legacy on American culture even today?
Well, one of the things that Roosevelt was very clear about in 1933 was that he wanted legal alcohol, but he also wanted alcohol taxed, and he wanted alcohol regulated. As a result, alcohol, which had been almost a Wild West drink before Prohibition, there were very few rules of any kind. And so Roosevelt wanted to make sure that we didn't go back to a system where you just sold anything to anybody anytime. And instead, you had a more regulated kind of environment with taxes that were actually necessary. And one of the major reasons that repeal took place in 1933 was that every government in the United States, city, county, state, and federal, was hurting for money. Meanwhile, there's Al Capone making $200 million a year untaxed. Huh?
So in the end, was it folly?
Yes, I think it's fair to say that it was folly. It didn't fit the fact that alcohol had been a traditional drink with Americans going back to actually the Mayflower, if you look at the alcohol that they brought on board. And so there just wasn't any way that a hard-drinking society could be, you know, turn the spigot totally off.
Well, and look at the stats. Today, Americans are drinking more than 2 gallons of alcohol a year on average. That's more than what they were drinking when Prohibition first started. So, you know, it's hard to get people who like to drink to stop drinking.
Well, they're not the same people, of course.
Yeah.
But it is interesting that alcohol consumption has gone up in the last 20 years. It went down from the 1970s until about 2000. There was a generation in there that didn't drink as much. And then what I think has driven the increase in the last 20 years is, and you could say it's the rise of the millennials, but what it really is the 3 million Afghan-Iraq war veterans, because they're self-medicating on alcohol in exactly the same way that World War II veterans did.
Hmm. That's William Rohrabaugh, professor of history at the University of Washington. Cheers. Thank you.
Cheers to you, too.
As the pace of infection from the new coronavirus accelerates in China, worries about global transmission have left governments scrambling. At least 630 people have died as a result of the virus. There are more than 31,000 confirmed cases, most in China. Hong Kong suffered its first fatality from the virus this week and imposed tougher restrictions for anyone returning from the mainland. NPR's Julie McCarthy looks at a territory on edge through the eyes of one of its residents.
We first met Catherine Chan last July, when the 27-year-old Hong Konger was on the front lines of the anti-government protests. She found that too perilous and turned to raising money for protesters. Friends who read her blog began to donate. Friends of friends gave her money. Soon Chan was busy buying protective gear, food, and medicine. But when we met again in November, she was struggling with what lies ahead.
I have no vision in the future, honestly. I just expect more pain and sorrows and sufferings coming. We can't predict what the Beijing, what the government will do next. I mean, above all, I have to stay alive.
With a deadly virus now stalking Hong Kong, staying alive takes on new meaning. Cases of infection have jumped 35% in a matter of days on the mainland. Watching from Hong Kong, Chan says there is fear, anger, and helplessness.
But above all is panic. It's just panic that you don't know what will happen tomorrow and you don't know what to do.
Chan said posts in early January on social media tipped her off to an outbreak on the mainland. It sounded like SARS, severe acute respiratory syndrome, which killed some 250 people in Hong Kong in 2003. But Chan says it was assurances from China that set off alarm bells.
The Chinese government keeps saying that we are okay, we are doing fine. That makes people more concerned, and because people don't trust them anymore, just like we don't trust the Hong Kong government anymore.
While experts struggle to pinpoint the cause of the virus and how it spreads, the number of cases in Hong Kong is ticking up. There are now 25 patients in isolation, including one death, a 39-year-old Hong Kong man who had traveled to the virus hotspot of Wuhan, China. Now authorities say a local outbreak has begun, with human-to-human transmission taking place in the city. Chan ventures out only with a mask over her mouth and goggles covering her eyes. She says climbing on a crowded public bus for her 90-minute commute each morning has become harrowing.
Outside, there is virus. When I get on the bus, there is virus. When I get off the bus, there is virus. When I get into the my office, there is virus. Everywhere, just virus.
And she is dismayed by the lack of basic protection, like masks, which she says are in short supply and selling at more than 10 times the normal price.
Mask is supposed to be a cheap thing, handy thing, but some people cannot leave their home because they don't have any mask. It's just ridiculous.
Chan works in the airline industry, which is dealing with thousands of canceled flights. One major airline has asked employees to take 3 weeks unpaid leave because of falling demand. Chan has spent 18 hours a day handling anxious customers.
People are bombarding our customer service center, saying they're concerned of the current situation. They don't want to travel. They just want to stay home. They don't want to go anywhere.
Striking medical staff demanded this week that the government completely seal the border. Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam refused, saying that would be out of line with the World Health Organization's guidelines and its discrimination.
And we should not adopt a discriminatory approach in dealing with people flowing between different countries and places in trying to contain the spread of the disease. There are other measures which will help us to achieve that effect.
Such as a 14-day quarantine for anyone coming to Hong Kong from mainland China. Starting Saturday, non-residents must remain in their hotels or in an assigned government camp for 2 weeks. Hong Kongers arriving back must stay home, subject to spot checks. Violators face 6 months in prison. About half of the infected cases in Hong Kong's hospitals are mainland Chinese. Catherine Chan says the hatred for mainland China on display in the anti-government protests has only deepened. And she and her friends are angry.
We are always saying that we don't want to die because of this plague, because of this virus outbreak, because that would be the dumbest reason that we died for. We don't want to die for nothing.
The details of daily life in Hong Kong stand out. On her 90-minute commute, Chan won't take a sip of water for fear of removing her mask. Julie McCarthy, NPR News.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.